Hi, Cliff Goldston here again, and I want to talk about a scene from what's probably my favorite novel, and basically considered one of the greatest novels ever written. It's Fyodor Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. And in this novel, he explores themes about everything, you know, themes about just about everything. But a major theme coming through here is the question of the existence of God and the meaning of life and so on and so forth. And there's a scene in the book where Ivan Karamazov is talking to his brother, who's a monk, and Ivan represents more of the skepticism and so on, and his monk brother represents belief. And Ivan is talking about tragedies. And it's the age-old question of how can there be God when you've got all this pain and all this suffering? And there's one scene in there where Ivan tells his brother about a serf boy who was living on the estate of some great Russian landowner. And the kid accidentally threw a rock and hurt the landowner's dog. And the landowner asked what happened to his dog, and it was told that the little boy threw a rock at it. Well, to make a long story short, Ivan tells the story how the landowner had the boy stripped naked, about an 8-year-old boy, and sent his hunting dogs on him and just ripped the boy to shreds right in front of the boy's mother. Now, Ivan's point in this tragic account, and then he told the story about the Turks when they invaded Bulgaria, who threw babies up in the air and bayoneted them in front of their mothers. And he told the story about a Russian couple who just murdered and tortured their little girl. You know, his reason bringing all this was to ask the question, ultimately, about how could these incidents and other like them ever be justified? Ever be justified, even at the end of the age, when ideally God is going to bring a universal harmony and all the questions are going to be answered and all of God's ways are going to be justified before men and angels? He wants to know how. And let me read you here from a quote. Here's Ivan now talking to his brother, asking him the question. I want to see with my own eyes the hind lie down with the lion and the victim rise up and embrace his murderer. I want to be there when everyone suddenly understands what it has all been for. All the religions of the world are built on this longing, and I am a believer. But then there are the children. And what am I to do about them? That's a question I can't answer. For the 100th time, I repeat, there are a number of questions, but I've taken only the children, because in their case, what I mean is so unanswerably clear. Listen, if all must suffer to pay for the eternal harmony, what have the children to do with it? Tell me, please. In other words, his question, what about the children? In other words, who hasn't wrestled with these questions, especially those of us who believe in God? The children, what am I to do about them? How do we answer this question of pain and suffering of children? Now, see, this isn't so much a question that assaults an atheist or a conundrum that, assaults the skeptic. I'm not saying these people don't care about children suffering. I'm saying that, look, they believe in a meaningless, godless universe where these things just happen. No, the question, the children, what am I to do about them? This doesn't present the same philosophical problem to atheists as it does to theists, particularly theists who believe in an all-loving, all-powerful God. I mean, children ripped apart by hunting dogs or tortured by their parents, these fit an atheist worldview. These are just things that happen. But it's the Christian worldview, with its omnipotent and loving Heavenly Father, that just appears to be so inadequately configured to explain the kind of things that we see happening here, the pain and suffering. And this isn't a new question. Thousands of years ago, in the 3rd century before Christ, the 3rd century after Christ, a Greek philosopher, Epicurus, he asked the question, basically, is God willing to prevent evil? Then he is, is God willing to prevent evil or not able? Then he is not omnipotent if he is able but not willing. Then is he malevolent? Is he both able and willing? Then whence comes evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? See, that's the question. Is God able or not able? If he's able, why doesn't he do it? If he's not able, why call him God? You see, on one level, there are many, many good arguments for the existence of God. I mean, you got what's often called the cosmological argument, which says, look, there are really only two kinds of possible existence. Either something was created or something wasn't created. I mean, try to think of a third. Either something always existed, and if it didn't always exist and it exists, it means because it was created, or it was always there, one or the other. And then ultimately, if something was created, it had to be created by something, and you go on and on and on and on and on. Sooner or later, you got to stop somewhere. You got to stop at something that ultimately wasn't created. And who could that be? That be but God. Then you've got the, then you've got the moral argument for the existence of God, which I've talked about here before. I mean, where does morality come from? Where does morality, if everybody in the world suddenly believed it's okay to torture little children, would it be okay? No, we don't believe that. If suddenly everybody were to believe it's okay, if you're not comfortable with that, why? That means that morality doesn't come just from humans. It's got to come from something transcending humans. And for some people, that's very obviously, that's God. Then you got the teleological argument for the existence of God, which is basically in the design of nature, the purpose of nature. I mean, you look around, you see an awful lot of evidence of design, evidence of something thought this out before it put it together, and that for many people, the only logical explanation for that is God. Now, again, none of these arguments by themselves prove the existence of God, or even all them together don't either. The arguments are as good as far as they go, which isn't far enough. I mean, if they proved everything perfectly, then there'd be no need for faith. We would all would believe. Instead, all these different arguments, the moral argument, the teleological, the cosmological, and others, they all show reasonable and logical evidence for faith. Nothing more and nothing else. But here's where you run into the problem, though. Here's where the problem comes. Because however logical and reasonable all these arguments for the existence of God are, however, whether by themselves or together, they're not, you know, they don't answer Ivan Karamazov's question, the children, what am I to do about them? And again, however logical and reasonable all these proofs are for the existence of God, they're no more logical and reasonable than the question is, if God is all-powerful, if God is all-loving, if God can do all things, then why do you have things like 8-year-olds being ripped apart by hunting dogs? Or that was just, I don't even know if that was a true story or not, but I'm sure we all know horrible accounts of things with, you know, children, adults. We see it all the time. How do we understand a loving God in such a universe? It was a Scottish philosopher named John Hick. He phrased the question like this. If God is perfectly loving, he must wish to abolish evil. And if he is all-powerful, he must be able to abolish evil. But evil exists. Therefore, God cannot be both omnipotent and perfectly loving. Okay? You catch that. He's, you know, either he can't, either he's all-powerful and he doesn't want to abolish evil, or he's, you know, all loving and he can't abolish evil. So how do you deal with that? Well, I think the answer really stems from your understanding of what omnipotence means. We've got this idea of omnipotence, meaning God could do everything. But, you know, there's certain logical problems with that. Let me ask you a question. Can omnipotence create a triangle that has four sides? Okay? If God can do everything, can God create a triangle that has four sides? No. Because the moment it has four sides, what is it? It's a rectangle or it's a square. It's not a triangle. Can you see that? Can omnipotence create a circle with a square edge? I mean, can God, you know, it goes back to these obnoxious questions. Before I was a believer, I used to love to meet these Christians and say, well, can God create a rock so big he can't lift? Well, as silly as it might be, in there. There's certain important points there. Can God create a circle that's got a square edge? No, God can't, because the moment it has a square edge, it's no longer a circle. Can God make 2 plus 2 equal 5? Why not? He's God. He's omnipotent. He should be able to do everything. No, because the moment 2 plus 2, you put 2 and 2 together, the moment 2, it's 5, it's no longer 2 plus 2. Can you see the point? There's certain logical limits that just by the nature of reality that God has created. And now we come to what I think is the most important question. Can omnipotence create a love that is forced? Okay, catch this again. Can omnipotence create a love that is forced? Could God force you to love him? And I believe the answer is no, because the moment love is forced, it's no longer love. Just as a triangle, to be a triangle, has to have three sides, love to be love must be freely given, or it's not love at all. To force love is, you know, it's to annihilate. It's like when a proton and an antiproton meet. They annihilate each other. Love, by its very definition as love, must be free, otherwise it's not love. Can you see the points? What I'm saying is I'm saying that even God, the omnipotent and almighty creator, cannot create a love that it's forced. Because the moment it's forced, it's something other than love. Love to be love has to be free, or it's not love. It's as simple as that. Without freedom, love is as impossible as a Euclidean plane without breadth or width. See, God can create. See, God can force you to obey him. Without freedom. God can create obedience without freedom. He can create law without freedom. He can create order without freedom. And he can create compliance without freedom. But not love. God, we can't love God unless we are free. God can force every being in the universe to worship him. He can force every being in the universe to obey him. He can force every being in the universe to fear him. But he can't force a single creature in all of his creation to love him. Because love to be love has to be free, or it's not love at all. So you see the point here. If God wanted us to love him, he had to create us free. Okay? And otherwise we couldn't love. Now that's very interesting if you think about that too, because in the Gospel of Matthew, the first and most important commandment, Jesus said, is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. It's kind of ironic, funny. We're commanded to love God. But it's interesting that the first and most important commandment was really the only one, unlike adultery or killing, you know, the one that cannot be forced. The only one that by its nature has to be freely given, or it can't be given at all. And so here's the crucial point. The hinge upon which I think, in my own pathetic little way, I think in which the whole question of evil rests. The only way humans could have moral freedom is if they had the potential to make immoral choices. Without the potential, without the option for immorality or evil, humans could not be free. And if they could not be free, they could not love. Okay? Now this, though, leads to a deeper question now. It leads to the deeper question. Okay, God had no choice. God, if God wanted us to love him, he had to make us free. But then why did God create us to begin with? Why did he create us? If he knows everything, why did he know that we would eventually choose evil? You know, okay? In other words, God had no choice. If he wanted us to love him, he had to make us free. But why did God ultimately create us? Was there some logical necessity that we had to be here? Was there something, you know, our non-existence bring a logical contradiction into the universe? See, not that I believe so. I mean, there's no reason why we had to be here. So what is my point? My point is that God created us, knowing ultimately the beings that he created would choose evil. God created those beings, and if he's all-loving, why would he do that? If God knew what we were going to do, why would he do that? And if he's all-loving, then ultimately the answer has to be that God is going to have to bring out a greater good. Okay, that's the only thing we could think of, okay? That ultimately, if he's all-loving, he's going to bring out a greater good. Okay, so that brings up another question, though. That brings up another question. God's going to bring out a greater good. Oh, isn't that nice? There's some, you know, God's going to bring out some greater good while, you know, we poor schnooks are down here struggling in the dirt, struggling with this problem, that problem, and other thing. Why, God's up there in heaven, and he's going to bring out a greater good. How fair is all that? And that's a good question. And I really know of only one answer. Now, let me summarize here for a minute where we've been. God had no choice. If he wanted beings to love him, he had to create them free. Okay? But God didn't have to create us. He didn't have to create us, but he created us anyway, knowing that we would do evil. And yet, if he's an all-loving God, we have to bring out... if he's all-loving God, he's ultimately going to have to bring out a greater good. But that's wonderful. God's up there in heaven, and the angels are all floating around him doing their thing, while we poor schnooks down here are working through whatever greater good's supposed to come out of it. Well, you know, there's only one answer for that. And I want to read you a quote. I know it by heart. It's from our good friend Nietzsche, whom we've looked at already. And Nietzsche said something at some point. And I want you to listen to this, because I really, and this has done, kind of ironic that of all the people I would get the answer to the question of evil and with a loving God was Friedrich Nietzsche, but hey, I'll take where I could take answers wherever I'll get them from. I'll sift through the garbage can if I have to find truth. And in the end, Nietzsche said, in the final analysis, one experiences only oneself. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. When we grieve with the grieving, when we weep with those who weep, we suffer with the suffering, we experience what? We experience only our own pain, only our own anguish. We never feel anybody else's pain, whether a mother holding a feverish infant at her breast, whether, you know, somebody, you know, holding a spouse who's dying in their hand. You can't splice into anybody else's pain. And any pain you feel for anyone, any sorrow you feel for anyone, it's only your own pain. It's only your own sorrow. You know, when famine descended upon Ethiopian, tons of flesh withered and faded back into the earth, they did so one quivering ounce at a time, you know. Nobody ever felt anybody else's pain. There's no such thing as corporate agony, corporate pain. You know, we know only our own pain. We know only the amount of pain and suffering our individual body will allow us. Now, this is good. Because this means no one has suffered any more than anyone else than what one individual can suffer. We know no more suffering than our own personal metabolism allows. No more pain than our delirious cells can carry us, no matter how many miles of nerves are wired in us. In other words, we've never suffered more than a single individual could suffer. You think of, you know, we're overwhelmed by the numbers, you know, million killed here, hundreds of thousands killed here, and on and on and on. It's horrific as all that is. Every one of those people suffered only as individuals. No human being ever suffered more than what a single individual could suffer. But you know, in all of human history, I believe there's only one exception to that. There's only one exception to that, this limit of pain. And that's what I believe is the cross of Jesus Christ. Now, I want you to forget for the moment, forget about Christianity, forget about all those nasty Christians you've dealt with before, you've met, forget about all the history that you've seen, put aside all the sordid history of Christianity, which I'll be the first to admit has been pretty sordid, okay? Put aside all that. I want you to catch the essence. I want you to catch the essence of what I believe my Christian faith is. Putting aside all the other stuff, what I'm saying is that the creator of the universe, I'm saying the power that, according to the Bible, God created everything that was created, from electromagnetism, from the strong force to the weak force to the, you know, the Crab Nebula, from every planet, every star, I'm saying the power that created everything, this power, this God, shrank down, became a human being, and on the cross, all the pain and all the suffering and all the things that we know only as individuals, it all came upon him at once. See what I'm trying to say here? That we experience only our own fear, only our own pain, only our own. At the cross, I believe Jesus experienced it all. Isaiah 53 says he bore our griefs and carried our sorrows. What we know only as individuals, all of it fell on Jesus at once. See, here and here alone, I believe is the question that we ask. Okay, it all comes back. It all comes back to this question. Okay, God had no choice. If he wanted beings to love him, he had to create them free. Okay, just had no choice. God, he could do all sorts of things, but he can't do the logically impossible. Love to be love has to be free, or it just ain't love. Okay, so God had to create us free. But he didn't have to create us. Okay, there's nothing logically impossible about human beings not existing. Okay, but God created us anyway. Okay, and if he knows all things, if he knows the future, he knew that mankind would fall, he knew there'd be pain, there'd be suffering, there'd be evil, there'd be the Holocaust, there'd be famines, and on and on and on. And he did it anyway. And he did it anyway. But if he's an all-loving God, he's ultimately going to bring ultimate good out of it. Okay? Now, the ultimate good out of it. Then we come to the question, well, if he's going to bring good out of it, that's real nice. He's up there in heaven, and we're down here, pain and suffering and all these things. Why should God be safely ensconced up in heaven while we're going through everything down here? Well, that's a good question, but again, it comes back to the cross. It comes back to the cross. However much blood and sweat and tears have dripped under anemic moons, despite the cancerous color of the soul and the loathsome pain and suffering of the cries, no one here, none of us ever suffered more than a single human being can. Our pain has never surpassed our finitude. You know, no one ever ate more than what he or she individually could withstand. Because the moment a certain threshold was reached, boom! Death broke it off. By contrast, what I'm trying to say, and again, forget all that stuff about Christianity. Look, I come from Jewish background. You have to tell me about how pathetic Christian history is. I know it better than a lot of people. Putting aside all that, forget about so-called Christians, forget about churches, forget about all that. Put aside all that. I want to get to the core of what the beliefs are. And what I'm saying is that this God, when you look at the cross, what you see is this God, instead of him being safely ensconced somewhere up in heaven, you know, while all this is going on down here, this God went to the cross, and on the cross, he suffered the results of all the pain and all the suffering. Because again, Isaiah 53 says that everything, he bore our griefs and carried our sorrows. So that every pain and every suffering that any human being has ever felt, has ever experienced. As individuals, I believe that at the cross, because the sin, of the weight of the sin and the guilt and the suffering of the world went on God at the cross. So the point is, again, you know, we freaked out by a million here, 100,000 here, but everyone suffers just as individuals. In the end, as Nietzsche says, one experiences only one's self. You never know any more pain than what you alone could know. But at the cross, there was God. Again, putting aside all that, that was, we believe the it's crazy, but we believe that was the creator of the universe. The creator of the universe on the cross, suffering worse than what any of us ever suffered, because we know it only as individuals. And what we know only as individuals are kind of, you know, you take a magnifying glass and you put it up to the sun and it all honed in on Jesus. So let me one more time now, let me one more time go where we've been. Follow the logic on here for the best I can do. God had no choice. I'm repeating myself, but I tend to do that. And the older I get, I do it more. So get used to it. Age. God had no choice. If he wanted beings to love him, he had to create them free. God cannot force love. He just cannot do it. The moment it's forced, it's no longer love. So he had to create us free. And freedom is a risk. If we're truly free, we could do what we wanted. We could obey or we didn't obey. We didn't obey. And yet God knew it. He knew it, and he created us anyway, knowing all the pain and all the suffering that was going to come. And yet, despite that, he did it because ultimately he's going to bring a greater good out of it. I have to believe, as hard as it was, I'm like Ivan. I have a hard time understanding the greater good that came out of it, but I have to believe it, even though I don't understand it. A lot of things I believe I don't understand. I mean, please, I wouldn't get out of, couldn't start my car in the morning. I wouldn't, then don't understand how it works. But ultimately, God's going to bring a greater good out of it. But then again, the question is, God's up there in heaven, why we're down here struggling, why God's going to bring a greater good, how unfair. And that's a very good question. That's a very good question. But I believe we've got a very, very good answer. In fact, it's the only answer I know. It's the only thing I know that helps me get by and helps me understand this at all. And that's that God who knew all this was going to happen, knew what was going to happen. He knew that ultimately he would wind up on the cross. He that was God there. Remember, this was, we believe that was the creator of the universe. It's wild, I know, but think if you could really believe that's true. Think of what it would say about the character of God, the creator, if that was him. And what we know, what that little boy knew when he was ripped apart by hunting dogs, what every person who suffered, and every famine, and every disease, everything, what they know only as individuals, that thing all corporately, he bore in himself corporately what we know only one-on-one. Think of how much worse that must have been. Can you see the point? Nothing any human being has ever suffered with this thing of sin will ever be worse than what God himself suffered at the cross. Now, I know that doesn't fully answer Ivan Karamazov's question, the children, what am I to do about them? Doesn't, I don't think I'll, you know, get to heaven, I don't know if I'll have it all answered. It just helps me live with them unanswered now, which for me is good enough. No, it's more than good enough.